Thanks, Jim, for inviting. It's a very sweet and persistent invite, and I'm really glad we could make it work. I also want to thank my brother-in-law, who's taking care of my daughter right now, without whom I would not have made this possible, and I'm really, really happy to be here. So I'm tasked to comment on Canada, and I'm going to start out with a comment that's actually not in my comments, and that at least applies to the US chapter as well. I haven't read the Australian and New Zealand chapter, but these kind of nations of immigrants, and at least in those two chapters we've just heard about, it's a really celebratory term, and there is some good reason for that, but there's also reasons for why we should be careful about that, I believe, and Des pointed out the complete absence of race in the American discussion, but I want to point out to the absence of indigenous peoples in these two chapters, right? And we're talking about settler colonial states here, who now have renamed themselves, rebranded themselves, nations of immigrants, countries of immigration, and there's some wonderful work out there by Donna Gabaccio in the University of Toronto that looked at these terminologies over time in the United States, how the term country of immigration only emerged in the 60s as a celebratory term, kind of this part of John F. Kennedy used the term very strategically, but for a lot of American history, the term was emigrant, referring to white settlers as something positive, and the term immigrant was negative for those we want to keep out, Eastern Europeans, for example. And so it really, it's a recent thing to kind of use that in a way to push aside the past of colonization. And many would argue the ongoing nature of that. Right now in Canada, we have a big discussion about genocide. Is the Canadian government today still implicit in genocide against Canada's indigenous people today to this present day? Lettie Volpe at the University of Berkeley Law School has a wonderful piece that talks about the indigenous as alien, and she talks about how country of immigration has become the settler's alibi, right? We are reinventing ourselves from settlers to immigrants, and therefore we can move on from all of that. So I just want to kind of throw that out. I think it's something really important to pay attention to, and migration scholars have really totally blinkered when it comes to that part of history and also presence in these particular countries. So in terms of my slide comments here, I want to pick up on two things that are introduced in Jeff's paper. I don't want to critique them, I just want to build on them and highlight certain aspects. The first one is here the much-famed Canadian exceptionalism. I think Irene Blumrad really was a person who coined the term in her MPI report and refers to the relative lack of politicization of immigration and the absence of political backlash in Canada. And the explanations that are commonly given, there are many, many, many. Nobody knows which one is the most important one. I don't think we can figure that out, but I want to just point out to three that Jeff picks up on in this paper. The importance of high-skilled economic selection that kind of gives the sense of we are in charge, we kind of select our immigrants. The second, this pluralistic conception of national identity, multiculturalism being part of being Canadian, though the figures shown by Jeff also clearly show that, you know, we need to take it with a grain of salt. What do we really mean by multiculturalism? It certainly doesn't mean total tolerance of plural identities. There is an expectation of assimilation, looking at public opinion data. And then Canada's remote geography, which I think is actually really important, though not enough, because there are also a few other remote countries in this book that have politicized immigration politics. And as a political scientist, I do have to bring in more political factors here than are in the chapter. And I think that's important because I think some of these factors even account for the very fact that there is a high-skilled immigration policy that has been maintained, and for the fact that multiculturalism was invented in the first place and has not been abolished even under a conservative government. So it kind of precedes these factors that now are used to explain the lack of Canadian exceptionalism. And I want to say a few words about an insulated policymaking process in Canada when it comes to immigration policymaking and also ethnic minority electoral strength, which I think is really important then to explain the maintenance of many of these achievements. So what do I mean when I talk about political insulation? We saw a lot of public opinion data just there, and they're also in the chapter. And I think my main point is that Canadian public opinion is typically not mobilized on issues on immigration. So what you see in terms of the opinion polls are people responding in a context where immigration is not being discussed as a major problem. Yeah, you do get very different data when things happen. For example, on the West Coast, boats with 492 Sri Lankan asylum seekers arrive, and all of a sudden you see a spike of anti-immigrant attitudes. They're just like what you see in Europe. There is really virtually no distinction. But these instances when public opinion is mobilized through these kind of trigger events it doesn't happen very often. And one important thing is that politicians choose not to, for the most part, politicize immigration policy making. So my first bullet here is Canadian immigration acts are actually surprisingly meaningless. If you read them, you really don't know much about what actually is happening policy-wise because they take the form of framework legislation. They outline some goals and then some very broad provisions, but they leave a lot of what really matters in terms of policy to the regulatory process. So there, the comparison between the US and Canada is really instructive in terms of, I mentioned my commentary, you know, you want to increase the number of skilled workers coming to the United States, Congress has to sign off on that. In Canada, I mean, the executive has much more far-reaching powers too. Part of regulation is deciding how many immigrants should come in, how to divide up between humanitarian, economic, family immigrants, how to operate the point system, changes in terms of the weighting of points, what are the categories. All of that happens largely just within the bureaucracy. In many cases, it has to be signed off by Parliament, but that often happens without any discussion. So it's a really heavily executive-driven policy process, which is kind of the most fortuitous arena to make policy in if you're concerned about politicization, because the public does not know what's going on, learns relatively little about that. Even parliamentarians don't learn a lot about it often. As a Westminster system, right, the parliamentary opposition is pretty powerless, some exceptions in terms of minority government, but really it's a very different context from, again, comparing it to the United States, where Congress has so much power in terms of blocking, vetoing policy. I think I've already said that. And no, I'm not making the case that Canadian policymakers are not concerned about public backlash, that they don't think about it, because they do, but they do it for a large part in a very kind of proactive way, not this reactive way we see in most other countries. So we see elite consultations before regulatory changes are made, very much like in the Swiss case with a pre-parliamentary consultation process. And also, the immigration branch does their own immigration polls every year to kind of see, is there anything to look out for in terms of when, you know, raising figures and so on. Okay, so the second point here is about Canada's electoral geography, and that's quite brief, which is all major federal parties share in a pro-immigration consensus. Not on all issues, but on the issue that immigration is positive and that level should be raised, or at least maintained. Now, the ethnic minority vote is really strong in Canada as a result of, and again, comparing to the United States, much higher levels of immigration in proportion to the population, much, much higher naturalization rates. Canada has the highest naturalization rates in the world, I believe. And then, of course, geographically concentrated immigrant settlement. We put that together with the single-member district plurality electoral system. And if you want to have a majority in parliament, you need to court immigrant voters. You cannot afford to ignore them in Canada. And so we've seen this really, it was really interesting, and Phil Triodafopoulos has really written a great chapter on that in terms of the Conservatives coming to power in the 2000s and really trying to get at particular districts in Toronto and really endorsing multiculturalism, realizing they need to do that in order to attract immigrant voters. Right? You can actually rail against asylum seekers. That's not going to be unpopular among immigrants. But there are certain things like immigration is positive and multiculturalism is good. You don't touch those. Those are holy cows. All right. I just need to quickly get my water. I am parched. Okay, so we end up with a pro-immigration consensus and also the absence of viable far immigrant party, right? I think that's really important to explain the kind of holding on to multiculturalism, holding on to pro-immigration politics. Okay, I want to switch gears briefly and point to something that is in the chapter, but it wasn't really emphasized in terms of the impact. And this is something. In Canada, we talk about the shift from one-step to two-step immigration. I think Australia and New Zealand also use those terms. In the US, it's called adjustment of status. That's what you use in the chapter, but it's the same thing. So Canada, much more so than the US traditionally, has been a one-step immigration country. Family members and economic immigrants, for the most part, arrive with a green card in hand. They arrive as permanent residents, right? And so from the 70s to the 90s, and here I'm looking at economic immigration only, people arrived under one-step immigration. I just want to show you the figures here. If you look at the blue bars, that's the Federal Skilled Worker Program, i.e. the point system. And you can see as recently as 2000, and that if you go further back, it would have been the same, we have close to 90% of economic immigrants arrive with a permanent residence card in hand. Now you take it to the present, at least 2015 here, we've got only just over 40%. And I think that is a really important change. The chapter focuses on the increasing involvement of employers in these programs, which I think is also really important, and also really interesting in comparative perspective looking at the US. Because once you involve employers, the question is, can you again uninvolve them? Right, and if you look at comprehensive immigration reform in the US, and employers played a role in that not happening because they didn't want a point system. They wanted to retain control over selecting their immigrants through the visa system. So it's interesting to see whether that has any impact in Canada. But another aspect of these changes that the chapter describes is just that, the decline of one-step immigration. And the two culprits here are the yellow and the orange. Provincial nominee program, Canadian experience. I'm not going to bore you with the details. They're all in a chapter. I want to point out that what is often talked about is a positive thing. Oh, now we have all these programs where temporary foreign workers of some kind can adjust to permanent residence. I want to just point out to the extreme skill bias within that avenue to permanent residence. Yeah, it's really, really difficult for somebody who's recruited under a low-skilled category to transition to a permanent residence. So it's not a panacea. I also want to point out that it's not just the case that we are layering this two-step process over a one-step immigration process because the numbers have gone down, right? There's a replacement happening. Instead of one step, we're now having a much more precarious path to permanent residence that has a really high upper-skill bias. And final comment here, maybe we could argue that in increasing temporary admissions, as we've seen, and moving from one-step to two-step immigration, we're seeing some process of conversion that kind of Canada is not that much more exceptional in policy terms. That's it.